This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Kevin Lin. We're going to be discussing the election and the role that the immigration debate plays in this current election. Kevin, it's great having you back on the show.
Robert, always a pleasure to be here. It's, 2020 has been a heck of a year so far. And throwing a presidential election is contested and acrimonious as this, I think we're in for a heck of a last quarter.
Oh, yeah. Certainly it looks that way. To start things off, Kevin, can you give us kind of reintroduce yourself for the audience who hasn't listened to the previous shows and your personal political background and the two organizations that you're the director of, U.S. Tech Workers and Progressives for Immigration Reform?
Sure. Love to. Okay. Well, boy, it's funny. The last time we spoke, I think I was still living in Los Angeles. I've moved to Pennsylvania since then. I'm living here in the city of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And when people talk, they say, Kev, what are you politically? And I just say, look, I'm a lapsed Republican, an unrepentant Pierrotist, a failed Green, frustrated Democrat, and now I'm an independent. So I've been all around. I lived in Los Angeles for 20 years. And when I was there, I was actually on the executive board of the California Democratic Party. I was a delegate to the Progressive Caucus. So I was very active. And I used to actually head the Pasadena Democracy for America, which was the afterburner organization of Howard Dean's 2004 run for president. And
I mean, this is a slightly off-topic tangent, but it's relevant. What's interesting is looking at the history of the Democratic Party, Howard Dean was the one putting out a strategy of appealing more to the working class in the Midwest and swing states. And then when Rahm Emanuel was, I think, advisor to Obama or head of the DNC, he actually was, then we saw a kind of change away from that strategy. But anyhow, if you want to comment on that and
sure,
continue with the introduction.
Sure. You know, Howard Dean was very much a centrist. And in 2004, I mean, the Democratic Party was really on the ropes. They didn't hold the House. They didn't hold the executive branch. I think they might have even been out on the Senate at the time. But it was bad. Things were pretty dire. So you had two candidates running in 2004 who were quote-unquote progressives. You had Dennis Kucinich and you had Howard Dean. And after the election, it was pretty easy to spot the progressives in the Democratic Party because you were either wearing Kucinich swag or you were wearing Dean swag. For those who remember, I'd love to hear from them. And so, but Howard Dean, it was actually, so the idea was that he ended up becoming head of the Democratic National Committee, and his mission in life was to restore the majority to the Democratic Party in the Congress and get a Democratic president elected. And it wasn't easy at first because progressives were still very much on the outside of the party. In fact, we had met one Saturday. A group of us in California, in Los Angeles, came together in LA, and groups met all over the country. And we pretty much told the Democratic Party, either Howard Dean becomes head of the DNC or we walk. So for 2 years, we did an amazing grassroots ground game. Both the folks in Progressive Dems of America and the folks at in the Democracy for America chapters across the country, and we retook the House in 2006. And all of a sudden, and that was really the beginning of the end, because everyone became a progressive at that point. It became very watered down. And progressivism between 2004 and 2006.
I remember back in the Bush era, if you were a progressive, it basically meant that you were anti-war, pro-environment, like the economic issues dealing with like regulating corporations. But this was actually prior to the woke issues, which are dominant now, both with progressives who supported Bernie and with the establishment.
Absolutely. It was very much principle-inspired versus politics or doctrine-inspired. For instance, during the Bush administration, it was really easy to get people in the streets protesting the war in Iraq, our presence in Afghanistan. But when a Democrat hit the presidency, as Obama did in 2008, you couldn't get people in the streets to protest. But that was just the way the differentiation that had occurred over the last few years was expressing itself, where all of a sudden progressivism stopped being about getting rid of the corporatists in the Democratic Party, and more about, well, how do I show I'm a progressive? Well, I'm going to be more left than the next left person, and more left, and more left. And then enter woke culture, shake and bake, and you have what passes for progressivism today.
If you want to kind of reintroduce the two organizations that founded, U.S. Tech Workers and Progressives for Immigration Reform, and are you focused more on U.S. Tech Workers now, or are they both equally active?
The focus has really become U.S. Tech Workers. We founded PFIR, Progressives for Immigration Reform, in 2008 as a way to have a conversation with my progressive brothers and sisters and people left of center on the need to restrict and better regulate immigration. So it really worked for everyone, the citizen as well as the new arrival. And I had helped found PFIR as one of the founding board members. And when I moved back to the East Coast, our executive director in D.C. wanted to move on, and we needed to fill the spot, and I took it over. And within about a year, I realized that when we were looking at the labor implications of unbridled immigration, we were looking at people that were, the less skilled workers that were, made vulnerable by migrations of people who were, largely unskilled, less poorly educated workers. We didn't realize that it was our skilled workers that were being abused by these employment visa programs that were being used to displace them, where you had instances like Disney, Abbott Laboratories, SoCal Edison, PG&E, and numerous other companies that were using people brought here on H-1B visas to displace them. Because what they would do is they would contract a company, let's say American Express, would contract with, or Anthem Insurance, would contract with an Indian consulting company like Infosys or Tata Consultancy Services or HCL. And they would bring in a group of H-1B visa workers. They would do a knowledge transfer with the American citizens that were in that workforce, whether they be native-born or naturalized, men or women, didn't matter where they're from. But if you were not part of this, and understand, over about three-quarters of all H-1B visas go to one country, India. It's a pipeline of cheap labor.
That is relevant to the bill that Kamala Harris was sponsoring, and I want to get to that later. But yeah, with the tech industry overall, are you sympathetic to calls to unionize by the workers?
Absolutely, because we had an amazing win on August 3rd. And this is the first win, frankly, we've ever had. I had read an Intercept article about the Tennessee Valley Authority and how the IT workers there were about to be displaced by not one, but three different consulting firms were going to come in and outsource all IT operations. And they had just started to lay off and displace their workforce, do the knowledge transfer. Well, the good thing is they have a union there. And Gail Henson was the local union leader, and talk about a fighter. And they got buy-in. All the workers came together collectively, and they began to fight this. But they were pretty much alone. And I went down. I spoke at one of their events. And when I was driving back up through the Shenandoah Valley to Pennsylvania, I thought to myself, golly, if we can just do an ad that would get President Trump's attention and get him to see what's going on at a quasi-federal government private industry, maybe he would do something. And we did. We got his attention. And as a result, on August 3rd, I and eight workers from the Tennessee Valley Authority met with President Trump, Vice President Pence, Secretary Scalia, Deputy Secretary Cuccinelli, and several others in the cabinet room. And not only did Trump fire the chairman and one of the directors of the board that day for the Tennessee Valley Authority, the CEO got a message while we were in this meeting and said, wait a minute, we're rethinking the outsourcing. And at that time, too, the president signed an executive order protecting federal jobs from being outsourced to foreign workers and consulting schemes by H-1B visa dependent companies. So it was a great victory, one of the few we've had in this long struggle.
So there was a presidential debate last night as of the show being recorded, and immigration was not really an issue. The moderator, Wallace, didn't bring it up, but the thing is, like, just looking at overall, I don't even think there was a clear winner. It was a total joke. Like, neither candidate came out strong. Just kind of the bickering back and forth. Nothing serious about policy. Basically giving a message to their own respected bases. But nothing really notable came out about this. And it's just one debate, but this is basically what the election has gotten to. A lot of people are just saying, like, it really feels like latter years of, like, a declining empire even. Do you have any thoughts on the debate?
Yeah, I do. You know, and it's interesting that you talk about the decline. And I think the Republic died a while ago. The empire is seeing its heyday at this point. And to make sense of things, I find myself going back into history. For instance, I started reading Montaigne's history, essays, and then rereading Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian Wars. And there's a lot of insights to be had from there. And it's funny, I was watching the riots in Boston, or Portland rather, and there was a quote from Montaigne that came to light, and he goes, the problem, and this is at a time, it's the Reformation, and he's in France, and so you have the Huguenots, the Protestants, against the Catholics, and it's become a war, it's become a shooting war, and he goes, the problem with civil wars is it makes us all sentinels in our own homes. And that really hit home while I was reading his essays and and watching what was going on in Portland, here in my home in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So I think you're right. And what the debates inform us of at this time, it shows that the sides can no longer get together. And I'm reminded of a passage in Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian Wars, where he talks about how there was a time in Athens when you, like, for instance, you and I could have a debate, and I would go, you know, Robert, I'll give you this, but understand, I think you're wrong here. And you might come and say, yeah, I can understand, but Kev, you're all wet on this, this, and this. But Thucydides went on to describe, in the current time, he said, that would be seen as treason, you know, and that would open you up possibly to getting killed. if you were to give that to the other side, that, you know, that little bit of deference to the other side.
Yeah, it for sure is the most divided that it's been in the nation's recent history. Going over Trump's record and mentioning that you met with him about this deal with about the Tennessee Valley, you have any thoughts? So his initial restriction on foreign tech visas, that was earlier this year, like late spring, and then do you have any thoughts on the recent announcement by the DHS and State Department about granting more workers' visas? So Neil Monroe and Breitbart wrote an article about about that, and do you think the initial restriction was just Trump using it as a political ploy, or do you think, are you able to get an impression of where Trump is coming from?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that, because there isn't an easy answer to it. And there's not an easy answer because I believe Trump is sincere. I believe he is sincere about Buy American, Hire American. But what happens is there is a deep state, and it really played out in, for instance, when on June 22nd, when he did Proclamation 10052, which a month before he had put a suspended entries of immigrants. And then a month later, on the June 22nd, he suspended entry of people coming here on non-immigrant employment visas. And what happens is a proclamation is made, but then it has to be implemented. So what happens is guidance is published. And in this case, the guidance was published by the Department of State. And in the proclamation, they talked about the different categories of workers that or employment visa workers that would be suspended. But there was an exception, and the exception was in the national interest. Well, when you looked at how the policy was worded, pretty much everyone was an exception. It's almost like there were no restrictions. And that's how the deep state operates. It operates through frustrating the intentions, through bastardizing the policy, also through slow walking things. But then also, as we're seeing, for instance, you mentioned the article with Neil Monroe. Now, there are people that would like to think that Neil Monroe was misrepresenting the facts. He was not. Several attorneys were, as he was, equally beguiled by what was going on. And this is a case where the USCIS opted to enforce and follow policies they could have not. But, you know, they'll say, well, the law complies us to move people, since the family green card visa category is undersubscribed to because of COVID, so fewer people coming here. Well, we're just going to push people who are already here on H-1B visas, other employment visas.
Did Secretary of State Pompeo have a role in this?
I don't think Pompeo had a role. He had a role in the policy for 10052, but this is the thing, and I'll be honest with you, Rob, I don't know. I can't draw a bead on where this came from, because in the Obama administration, very similar guidance was passed, and it was rescinded before it became effective. And it's pretty technical, and for those who aren't familiar with how our immigration visa system works, even if I'd explain it would probably be a little difficult, but every month a visa bulletin is published by USCIS, and there's a filing date chart that's published, as well as a final action date chart. And essentially what they're saying is, okay, we will accept people to come into the green card visa queue, the green card queue, and get be eligible for green cards and employment authorization documents who filed before this date. Well, for some reason, between September and October, they dropped that back 5 years.
With Trump's kind of overall economic record, which relates to immigration, but just economics in general, so we started out having more populist advisors like Peter Navarro. Do you think it's relevant that he has advisors now more like Larry Kudlow? He was from the Reagan administration, but he's basically like free market, supply-side economics. Like, how relevant is that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's very relevant. You know, Peter Navarro is a saint, but he's isolated. There are a couple white, you know, we want to call them white hats, white knights in and around the president, but they're few and far between anymore. You have people like his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, Seidel, who came in from Microsoft, and others that, although the president's intention might be hire American, theirs is anything but. They listen to the corporatists. And I gotta believe that it's not just about immigration. It's more overarching.
Yeah, it's the same with how Trump handled the coronavirus bailout, the CARES Act. Like, most of it did, like, all these massive corporate bailouts, as opposed to like, his excuse was that the Democrats that they were being obstructionist, and there might be some truth to that, but I think he did have a chance to act on that, and he basically, the CARES package that Trump did sign was clearly influenced by that agenda of Kudlow.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, you know, that's $3 trillion, of which, what, $350, $500 billion actually made its way to the people, like in the form of PPP loans, in the form of the $1,200 check. I can't think of the fellow's actual name, but he has this amazing podcast called Quote the Raven. And he was doing an interview with the Wall Street for Main Street guy. And they looked at that, all of the stimulus spending that went into CARES Act and others. And you could have given every American a check for $46,000 with that. And what did we get? You know, $1,200 if we qualified. It tells you there's a huge disconnect. And when I talk about this overarching, because you look at the way they use immigration and trade, again, it gets back, and we discussed this before, the whole concept of neoliberalism, which is the free movement of people and capital across borders to do nothing more than maximize profit. And it basically works to destroy the nation state. Because you mentioned the COVID pandemic. And, you know, Trump's response in February was the right one, because the gold standard for stopping or fighting pandemic is, number one, cut off the entries from countries that are infected.
Do you think he waited too long to act on that?
Sure, everyone did. I was fortunate. I have acquaintances who, you know, mine the dark web, and I was getting reports out of China from them. For instance, the People's Liberation Army Navy was trying desperate to get its hands on every ounce of ascorbic acid it could. Ascorbic acid is what you use to make vitamin C, and they were locking it away on naval bases. There is a reason their navies didn't come down with COVID, because they were fortifying them with vitamin C, vitamin B. They knew what they were doing. And so by late January, I was myself ordering N95 masks from Amazon when they were still readily available, stocking up on food and toilet paper. And on my Facebook page, I was advising friends and family to do the same thing. But again, getting back to what's the gold standard in pandemic response is cut off the travel. That's why New Zealand did so well. They're an island. They could cut off the incoming traffic.
I am critical of Trump's handling, and not just Trump, but just leadership overall. But you do have to kind of factor in that America has interstate travel and it's one big country. It's different than other parts of the world where it's many small nations who can easily secure their borders.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a point where small is beautiful. And if you have an immigration system that is somewhat unbridled.
Well, interstate. Interstate travel as well.
Yep. Exactly. Interstate as well, because once you come in, I can't recall exactly when. I think it was it early February, late January, when we restricted initially travel from Wuhan. But there were two flights coming in every week from Wuhan to San Francisco. And the first thing you do is restrict, quarantine, and then you mask, and then you trace. And that all becomes difficult if you don't have a well-regulated immigration system, because you don't know who is in the country and where they are. It's very different than it was when my mother came here in 1952. Twice a year, she would appear in front of an immigration officer, and they would ask a list of questions. They would make sure that she was working, that she was not a public charge. And then she would always tell me, she'd say, and then he'd ask me the most embarrassing question. And I go, what's that? And she goes, he'd go, and are you doing anything else to make money? So, I mean, it was very well regulated. A little heavy-handed maybe, but you need that to make sure that the immigrant, because when my mother came here, she would tell me the stories. She went to work doing the books in an account in a hat manufacturer. And after a while, she would be getting more money in her paycheck. And she asked, she said, well, why is this? And they're like, well, Nora, we don't have to check your numbers. You're doing a great job, better than everyone else. So it was a good time for immigrants. No one was getting exploited. And it was a good time for native born. We built up this middle class. And we don't even have the capacity to have that conversation anymore. And
just the impact of the pandemic on the economy and unemployment rates. And there, you had an article on one of your sites, I think it was U.S. Tech Workers, it may have been the other one, Progressives for Immigration Reform, about immigration rates and unemployment. But just looking at the economy right now, Trump is going to downplay the economic crisis, but that's actually expected because he basically has to kind of defend the status quo because he's running for re-election. What I find pretty remarkable is that the establishment media, who you'd think would want to make Trump look bad, has also been downplaying the economic crisis.
Yeah, I think because they're all paid by the same masters at this point. You know, let's just take looking at it again from this immigration standpoint, because what we're seeing on the ground is those here on employment visas are not getting laid off, but the Native American force, but all the citizens are. For instance, there's a large consulting firm, Capgemini, and recently it laid off three workers. One of them, a naturalized citizen from South Asia, another one, a naturalized citizen from the Caribbean region, and another one, a native-born American. But the native-born American, they replaced him with two H-1B visa workers, and the other two were working at a job site that was pretty much all H-1B and L-1 workers from one country, India, and none of those were fired. So that's what's going on. And when you look, you had mentioned Neil Monroe's article and how they're now pushing people who are in the green card backlog and giving them essentially a green card light, an EAD, to work here in the U.S., it really speaks to where they're prioritizing foreigners that are cheaper and more exploitable than American workers at a time when we still have 30 million people that are unemployed. It just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, the media is totally downplaying the severity of the economic crisis. And looking at the recovery, it's hard to say if we're going to see like a Great Depression, but the idea of like a K-shaped recovery where basically it's more extremes in income inequality, I mean, that basically does seem a pretty accurate description.
I think you're dead on there. Because, I mean, who's winning? Jeff Bezos and online shopping is winning. However, Main Street America is hurting. There is that report by Yelp where 60% of restaurant or small businesses on Yelp are not going to be reopening. I know where I live in a loft building. It used to be an old shoe manufacturing company's offices. And below me, just before COVID started, this amazing bakery had moved in and they set up shop and they'd been operating probably about a month. And they haven't opened and I doubt they will ever reopen. So that's just an example of what's going on Main Street. And how long can this go on? Well, I guess so long as they can continue to print the money to prop it up. I mean, we're not seeing productivity gains in the stock that's boosting the stock market. It's really companies like Apple buying back their stock.
Yeah, that's the whole thing with the stock buybacks. I mean, that was actually when Trump was talking about the Trump administration having a booming economy. A lot of that was being propped up by corporations and stock buybacks. But the thing is, like, looking at the pre-COVID unemployment rates for Trump, I mean, I have heard the theory that that unemployment rates of people not searching for jobs was not showing up. I've heard that argument. I think we discussed this on
a previous show, but I also think the six. Mm-hmm.
So I also think there has been job growth under Trump prior to the pandemic, but it has been disproportionately like low wage retail jobs. So Trump, he hasn't really done that much to help the middle class as far as creating like high-paying jobs. And
I agree, and the middle class jobs, because the displacement that I mentioned earlier that's caused by, you know, people, this pipeline of H-1B visa workers coming in working for Indian consulting companies that are contracted with displaced Americans, this has been going on unabated. So right now as we speak, Ascension, which is a company that has about 60 to 7, it's hospitals, that's Roman Catholic, they're outsourcing over 100 IT jobs. And right now, the workers there are currently training their H-1B, their replacements that work for HCL, an Indian consulting H-1B visa dependent company. And by Thanksgiving, they will all be out of jobs. And they're getting a severance check because they're training their replacement. Now, how awful is that? Peabody Energy, we just found out that they're going to be doing the same thing, outsourcing not just IT, but other departments as well, and offshoring those jobs directly to companies in India.
Do you think with remote work could replace the importation of foreign workers on visas with just outright outsourcing, because it's no longer necessary to have a physical presence, and it might actually be a lot cheaper for them?
Yeah, I think that could help, and on two fronts. Better, maybe preferable, for two reasons. When I lived in California, I did property tax consulting, and it was probably around 2012, 2011, I was at a conference in the Bay Area, and there was a panel discussion, and the head of real estate for Google was talking, and he said, you know, I run 93 buses from South San Francisco down to Mountain View, and I could probably up that another 20 easily. Because what it is at that time, Google was, we want to have all of our people working here on the same bench. So, but a lot of people preferred, you know, the urban experience living in San Francisco. So the solution was to run these buses. And now with remote working, the need to do that isn't there. And that was actually, and the second thing is, and that was one of the sticking points with American workers, is they would say, oh, you guys, we're going to have to, you know, this is a high-cost area. We're trying to downsize here. And the Americans are like, well, just let us work from home. Like, oh, no, we can't do that. Well, now they can. And I think that's another alternative to maybe helping retain American jobs is allowing Americans to work remotely. And more to that point, this is where we saw the failings of offshoring to India during this pandemic, because as was explained to me by the director of a large technology manufacturing company, in India, you know, they might have these beautiful, like IBM, Hewlett Packard, they'll have these beautiful campuses in Mumbai or Hyderabad, but the workers are bussed in. Maybe it's an hour and a half to 2 hours to get to the campus. They're coming from, they're living in hovels where they might have electricity, but internet might be intermittent. And then when they arrive at the campus, they'll have to get fed breakfast because they've been on the bus for a long time. And their working days are short. But these are people that can't really work from home. So when India went into lockdown, everyone probably noticed they were having issues with their hotel website that they might be looking to book something on, or their bank that might have, you know, operations in Hyderabad at a campus there. So it's kind of shown that, you know, if we want to be more resilient and self-sufficient, we might want to keep a lot of that knowledge work at home. Because I'll tell you, Robert, if we haven't gotten the wake-up call where we couldn't even manufacture our own personal protective equipment, you know, I'm talking just the mask. What happens when we don't have control of our financial data, our insurance data, our healthcare data, and it's being serviced here by people from another country in the U.S. as well as offshore? That's a big problem.
And with Trump, do you have the numbers, the statistics on to the degree which illegal immigration rates have declined under Trump? I've seen sources from more establishment sources have claimed there's been a pretty dramatic drop.
There's been a extraordinarily dramatic drop for 2020. Because of COVID-19, and there were drops in 2019. I can't give you, I don't have at my fingertips the exact numbers. And in 2018, it was up and down because you had the migrant caravans coming up, as well as you had a surge in border arrests, which indicated more people were coming into the country illegally. But 2020 is, you have to kind of look at it as an outlier because of the travel restrictions.
Yeah, I've seen different sources that have shown like a decline in overall numbers. As far as Joe Biden goes, Neil Monroe also had an article on Breitbart about Biden's immigration plan, taking into account hypothetically amnesty, legal immigration, and family reunification, estimating, like, I think I was up to about 50 million people. Do you have any overall thoughts on Biden's immigration proposal, his record in the Senate and as vice president under Obama? And would you say, is it a generic sort of Democratic Party immigration proposal, or does this go further than past Democrats such as Hillary Clinton or Obama?
I think the former. I think it's very generic what we've come to expect from, and we can call it the Democratic Party, we can call it the Republican Party sans Trump, but it's these neoliberal concepts again of moving people and capital across borders to promote profit and to denigrate the nation state. Because workers who might work collectively to, one, keep their jobs or demand more money, more salary, more benefits, you know, that gets in the way. That or a alert citizenry that may get in the way of consumer buying decisions. You know, this is what has been foisted on us since the 90s, really since the Clinton administration. It kind of started with George H. Bush, even before that with the Tequila Wars. But
the thing is, to what degree do you think that people on the right are maybe overly hysterical when they talk about maybe the sheer numbers? They talk about maybe Biden's proposal as being extremely radical. Are they overly hysterical? Or do you expect more of the status quo of similar policies that we saw under Obama?
I see similar policies under Obama with an eye, because I don't really see Biden as running the government. I don't know. Do you follow this fellow, Martin Armstrong?
I'm vaguely familiar with that name.
Yeah, I like his economic advice, his geopolitical advice. And he told this story recently where, you know, he began to be put out there to go and meet with prospective candidates for president, ostensibly to brief them on geoeconomics. But really, he was there to assess them because the powers that be would ask him, well, what do you think? Are they the right stuff? And he'd give them his opinion. And then he was asked to go down and visit George W. Bush. And they prefaced it with, you know, this guy is really stupid. And he's like, well, why do you want him? Oh, don't worry. Other people will run the government for him. He's just electable. And I think when you look at Biden, who I think you'd have to be intellectually dishonest to say there isn't cognitive decline there and there aren't issues that should preclude him from the presidency. So the idea, I believe, is, you know, this isn't the guy we're going to put in there to run the country. This is a guy that will, you know, who understands that the United States is a multi-trillion dollar enterprise and here are the cogs in it. And by the way, you citizens don't have a say in this.
Yeah, Kamala Harris as the VP, she'll obviously play a major role. And there's a good chance she could be a future president.
I wonder what the Vegas odds are on that.
I've seen some. I think it's one out of 20 that she could become president.
Good.
One out of 20. So yeah, I mean, she did seem to be she was the favorite of Silicon Valley, the donor class. Do you have thoughts on Kamala Harris's record as California senator, the sponsorship of Fairness to High-Skilled Immigrants with Mike Lee, which would abolish or loosen country caps, and then just the overall backing of corporate lobbies, including big tech, behind the Biden-Harris ticket?
Well, let me go back to, let's walk it back in my thoughts generally of her fitness. I do not see her fit for office for several reasons, because when she was the attorney general in California, it was following the 2008 economic collapse. She had her foot on the necks of the big banks, for the robo signing, for the fraud in the commercial mortgage-backed security.
The scandal with Mnuchin?
Yeah, I mean, that's even light. But I'm talking, she, as the attorney general in California, she had all the evidence. And she chose to let them all go with a little rap on the wrist. And then she becomes the senator from California. Barbara Boxer vacates her post and, you know, Kamala is in there. So to me, this is someone being groomed by the corporatocracy, someone who will definitely take orders. Because I've just never seen her really buck up to the system. There's always hope that when someone gets into the office that they will do an about face, but I don't hold out that hope. And the fact that she is a co-sponsor of S-386, her role in it is downplayed because Republicans are the majority in the Senate and Mike Lee is the Republican sponsor, so it's the kind of the Mike Lee bill. But she's the sponsor on the Democrat side.
It's interesting because Dan Crenshaw signed on to that, and he's being promoted as like the inheritor to Trunks' legacy.
Yeah, it's. I think people are really confused on this because the propaganda has been put out. The propaganda has just been so slick, you know, and it goes back. I mean, let's go back. Remember in, you may not, sorry, I'm aging myself, in the early 90s, you know, there's this cry for NAFTA because, you know, there were jobs that didn't have an economic right to exist. And then later, when we saw these mass migrations in the 90s from Latin, South America, and Mexico, there were jobs that Americans just wouldn't do. And now we're told with our skilled jobs, I mean, this, we're the country that created Intel, Microsoft, Apple. We put a man on the moon. There are trying to tell us that there are jobs Americans can't do.
It's cheaper to hire someone who's educated overseas than for the state to have to pay for their university education and training.
Well, that's actually the problem. Let's look at doctors, for instance. So if you go through 4 years of undergraduate, then you go through 4 years to get your doctor, your medical degree. Now, what most people don't know is every year, 6% of graduates of U.S. medical schools do not match for a residency, which means if you don't get a residency upon graduation, you will never get a license. And if you don't get a medical license, you will never practice medicine. So you might have gone anywhere from $250,000 to $400,000 in debt, in student debt, to get a medical degree, and you'll never practice. Yet at the same time, there's 1,200 Americans not getting residencies at U.S. teaching hospitals. 3,600 international medical graduates are. There's a hospital in Chicago where every resident selected into those programs is from one country. It's like, wait a minute, are you really looking for the best and brightest? You know, as one head of a hospital system told me, he said, let me be candid with you. If you think the residency match is anything but a fraternity rush, you're fooling yourself. So, like, we know, for instance, the demographics of who gets accepted to medical schools here in the U.S., but we have no transparency into the match, who actually, the demographics of the people that are matching to residency programs. So here, Americans are spending huge amounts of money on their educations, and they can't get jobs.
Just looking at the kind of the overall debate about immigration, I initially speculated that the pandemic and economic situation would lead to more restrictionist sentiment. Trump plays on that when he calls the coronavirus the China virus, but I think he's been, I mean, that's just kind of crude, and it's not really, he didn't really have an effective strategy and take advantage of the situation in sort of to his original core message. But the thing is, that actually didn't happen. It just seems that we had like the protests in response to George Floyd over the summer, starting in the end of May, and it just seems like the culture war issues taking hold on like race relations, including protests, but also cancel culture. And I've actually seen sort of some polls have showed increased sympathy for higher levels of immigration among Democratic voters more recently. And it seems like with the GOP, it's become more kind of a wedge issue, similar to how abortion has long been. And then anyone who is opposed to Trump, if you see Trump as disastrous as a president, you're going to see the more liberal immigration side as the right side on the culture war. And Trump is also associated, I think he's further associated immigration with the culture war, which could have actually a long-term impact on the political discourse. That's contrary to what you wanted to accomplish with progressives for immigration reform.
Yeah, but I think you're a little early in that thinking, because as a country, traditionally, we have always become more restrictionist when the economy has gotten worse. Actually, then maybe in the next one or two years we'll see it. I think we'll see it play out because the impact of, I mean, let's face it. We've kept this economy on life support since 2008. I think we should have been in a depression in 2008, and we should just be beginning to come out of it over the next few years now. But we, you know, who would have thunk in 2008 that they would do things like TARP, QE1, QE2, QE3, and now a, you know, $3 trillion stimulus act. And now you look at the HEROES Act that's in Congress right now being voted on, you know, trillions more, another $3 trillion. I saw that number in the HEROES Act. So we're keeping this economy on life support and all the problems that typically come to that, the wide scale, not just the unemployment, but, you know, people losing their homes. And we are seeing it, but more in slow motion. Los Angeles, every time I go there, I'm blown away by the increase in homelessness.
Well, the last time I visited LA was in January, but have you visited since the pandemic?
Not since the pandemic, no.
I was in the Bay Area recently, and I did notice, like, along the main freeway in the East Bay. I mean, the issue with homelessness it was an issue 5 years ago, but I just was kind of, I think it was like Emeryville or West Berkeley along the highway, like the sheer size of these encampments along the harbor.
Yeah, it's amazing. What I saw when I was in LA in December, and I used to live in downtown Los Angeles, homelessness had grown exponentially. You know, every underpass had homeless cantons and encampments. It's amazing. These things are starting to become little self-governing bodies. And this is this economic train wreck in slow motion. But when the unemployment benefits begin to really expire, the stimulus begins to expire, we're starting to see that now. I mean, Disney just today announced it was laying off 28,000 people, 67% of its workforce or something like that.
It does seem like we could face a depression or real economic crisis, but like you listen to the pundits and just you talked a lot of, even just talking to ordinary people, I think a lot of people, some people have political motives to cover that up. I think that because the idea might be terrifying to them, they don't want to imagine that, but that's just a reality. There's a very good chance we could face that kind of crisis in the next year.
Absolutely. I think spring 2021, we're going to have to face the devil. And, you know, Trump was actually, in 2016, he said it. We're in a bubble. He said that during one of the debates. We're in a bubble now. And I think when Americans begin to look at the fact that their unemployment benefits have run out, they really are up against the wall, and the solution, the economic solution corporations are putting out there is to bring in more immigrants that they can exploit more and get at a better rate. I don't think that's going to fly because one of my greatest frustrations since we started U.S. Tech Workers, Robert, is that we can't get tech workers to work collectively together, trust each other, and fight back. You know, earlier this year, Vanguard, one of the large mutual fund companies in the country, announced that it was going to outsource 1,300 jobs to an Indian consulting company, Infosys. And Infosys was going to be in a building right next to one of theirs. Those jobs would move over there, and in a year, those employees would be rebadged to Infosys. Well, we know what's going to happen. Most of those jobs will eventually be offshore to India, and those workers who are now working for this consulting company that were getting great benefits and great pay are going to be challenged to find work, and eventually, as has been the case with many Americans that have been rebadged, the managers will make sure that they don't get put on jobs, and when they're not put on jobs, eventually they'll be terminated for not being productive.
Do you have thoughts on Trump's trade policies? how he ran on protectionism, and the degrees in which those policies have been effective. Like, I've actually heard a lot of the region, like the Rust Belt, it's still pretty economically devastated. But did Trump have any impact whatsoever on those policies?
Well, I think the good thing is he's, at least if nothing else, used his bully pulpit to call China the enemy. And it's not China, it's the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, this is a heartless and soulless organization. I was watching them transform in the 80s when I was an intelligence officer working in Korea for the U.S. Army. And to see this transformation, and I think the great thing about Trump is he's like saying, wait a minute, guys, we have taken all of our jobs, all these jobs that, and this is exactly what Perot was saying, Dr. Ravi Batra was saying back in the early 90s, that there are consequences, not only in terms of tax revenue and things like that, but as Ross Perot aptly stated, the brains always follows the manufacturing. So you wonder why China produces so many engineers, because they have a manufacturing base to employ them into. I grew up in the shadow of Bethlehem Steel, and there was a university, an engineering the school at Lehigh, and it was, you know, that was like how you entered your professional life at Bethlehem Steel by graduating from Lehigh and then going right across and working at Bethlehem Steel. And it was a top rated engineering program at the time, and now I think it's like ranked 63rd in the nation. Why? Because the where you would send these graduates doesn't exist anymore. And that's, you know, so much gets stripped out of us when we send these jobs overseas to play this wage arbitrage game. And ultimately, no one wins. At the end of the day, China cannot make it without the U.S. because they're desperate for our dollars to buy the resources they need to manufacture the goods to get the dollars, because no one's going to take RMB, yuan or wampum. Sorry, they're just not. They want dollars. This is a dollar-denominated world.
Do you have any further thoughts on the election, if you want to speculate about the outcome? Also, the long-term implications of if either Biden or Trump is elected, if it matters, or you see the same trends regardless of who wins?
Boy, there's a lot of speculation called for here, because what would a Trump presidency look like the last 4 years? You know, would he throw off a lot of the things that have bound him? You know, for instance, like just take trade policy. Everyone's talking about soybeans. Soybeans will take care of themselves. China is desperate for food right now. It doesn't take a genius to organize a trade deal in which our farmers would do really well. What we need to be doing is fighting back against Huawei and 5G and getting their microprocessors and components in all of our electronics. We need to push back against things like that. And that's the good thing Trump has done. If Trump does not get reelected, any hope, you know, with Trump, we at least have hope, I think. But with a Biden presidency, it will return to a China, most favored nation status way of doing business.
Yeah, I've been critical of Trump, but one important thing that was crucial that he did do was Trump did block the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have likely been implemented if we elected Hillary.
And it absolutely would have been. It's so funny because a Hillary supporter would come back and say, oh, no, she was against it. No, only after she was shamed into being against it. Exactly. So at least with Trump, I see hope. But with Biden, I see the corporatocracy really firmly entrenching itself. you know, on a personal level, this will significantly impact me and our movement that has been growing. I think they will, the knives will be out. They will come after immigration restrictionist groups like ourselves. And it'll make the going much, much rougher.
Yeah, cancel culture. You've had issues in the past involving reports from the SPLC, but cancel culture is getting out of control.
It really is. And it's tragic because, you know, perhaps it's one of these, we were talking about overarching things. Perhaps there are certain themes that repeat in history. And maybe there's a point where a country becomes self-loathing and all they can do is attack its own culture and not celebrate it. I personally celebrate Western culture. I think when you look at where liberal thought has come from, the concept of noblesse oblige, honor, integrity. Years ago, I had a client and he was from Lebanon and he had a number of hotels. And we were at lunch and I was, you know, being highly critical of America, like I am. It's kind of my norm. And he corrected me, said, no, you don't understand. In your country, a deal is a deal. If I have an issue with you, I can take you to the courts and more than likely, you know, find justice. Anywhere else in the world, you will not see that. It's, you know, how much, you know, who's, which family you're dealing with, how much of a bribe you're laying out. So those are the great things about America. And what I see with this woke culture where, and it, to me, it just all seems so misguided. And it's really, in a way, it's funny how it seems to just follow right along with the corporatocracy and their theme about weakening the nation state and weakening mores and values. And that has an impact. And so it makes me think of a, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the writer James Howard Kunstler.
Oh, yeah. He was on the show about several years ago.
Oh, great. You know, I'm a big fan of Jim. And he did a lecture on YouTube. And at the end, he made this pronouncement. He goes, don't ever let anyone call you a consumer. You're a citizen. And not only does that invoke, you know, certain rights, but also responsibilities, responsibilities for yourself, your community, your country. And that's an important aspect that seems to be getting lost in all of this, Robert, where we don't seem to be taking responsibility for our own actions the way we should. We don't seem to be wanting others to take responsibility. We don't seem to feel that there's a responsibility to safeguard the institutions of this country. So, yeah, I'm actually getting more pessimistic, and I have to apologize to your audience for that. I kind of subscribe to the Strauss and Howe view of the fourth turning, and I think it's
going to... The fourth turning is... the third stage is decay, and I think the fourth one would be chaos, so maybe... If you subscribe to that theory, we could be entering the fourth turning.
Yeah, and it's funny. I got indoctrinated very early in the 80s. I went to a small military college, and a woman named Ruthie Roberts taught us economics and accounting, and she introduced us to a Soviet economist named Kondratiev. And we call it the Kondratiev cycle. So he said, like, wow, every 70 years, certain things seem to repeat. And then you had people like Harry Dent taking that concept of demographics and putting consumer templates on it and talking about economies. And then you had Strauss and Howe kind of lay socio-political templates upon it and how we get, and they came up with the concept. So, you know, within this 80, 85 year cycle, you have four smaller cycles.
I mean, I am pessimistic about the next. I mean, who knows about long-term future predictions and speculations, but I'm pessimistic for the next decade, but I will say that it will be a lot more interesting to watch as a political observer than the 2010s.
That's for certain. And at the end of the day, as countries go, we're bounded by oceans on two sides, wilderness to the north and deserts to the south. So, you know, we could be free of things like invasions and things like that, where, you know, as Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, the only thing you might have to fear is fear itself. And to me, the most tragic thing to come out of this pandemic is the fact that both sides of the political aisle couldn't work together. And for instance, we talked earlier about, you know, Trump wanting to restrict travel early on. Well,
or yeah, making, you know, or just making with the lockdown, instead of finding practical solutions, a pandemic sort of became, it should have been like a health, usually health emergencies are less polarized, but like the pandemic was as polarized as a culture war issue like gay marriage and abortion would have been.
Absolutely. And that's really tragic. And we're facing the consequences of that today. I mean, we know a lot about how this virus operates, and we can take measures to control it without having to shut down the economy. We know the people that are most at risk are elderly and people with comorbidities. You know, they're obese or they have diabetes or, you know, other ailments. And we have to take all that into consideration because, you know, if you're the president of the United States, you have to weigh everything when you make a decision on whether to shut down or not. And, you know, yeah, so, you know, tragically, again, it became highly politicized.
We're at the end of the show. Kevin, do you want to plug your website, your two websites, and also do you have, for Progressives for Immigration Reform and Tech Workers, and also if you have any upcoming projects or announcements you want to plug?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Well, for if you're a white-collar worker and you're feeling a little job insecure that your job might be outsourced or offshore, you definitely want to go to www.ustechworkers.com. And be sure to sign up for our newsletter. The newsletter comes out every week. Over the next couple months, it'll be out bi-weekly, because a couple of our staff are going to be making moves, actually leaving major metro areas and going to smaller, less populated, more rural areas, which is what I had been urging everyone to do for some time. And if you understand that there are consequences to an ever-growing population, particularly here in a highly industrialized country like America, where our individual carbon footprints are so high, and you're thinking, wow, you know, when I was a kid, there were 200 million people in America.
Or 1 billion, if Matt Iglesias has his way.
Oh, yeah. I'll actually, on the PFR newsletter, I'm working on a rebuttal to that this week. So, yeah. So if you're concerned about, if you understand that there are linkages between population the environment and our ecosystems, you know, you can go to ourcarbonfootprint.org, or you can go to pfirdc.org or progressivesforimmigrationreform.org.
Kevin Lynn, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Robert, always a lot of fun. Thank you.